Hi there, fellow introverted mamas, and welcome to episode 5 of Literary Snapshots, in which we'll be discussing chapters 25 through 30 of Jane Eyre. We are nearing the end now, and things are definitely heating up in the plot, so this is going to be fun. But first, I just wanted to talk for a second about the coronavirus. I'm recording this near the beginning of the time when all of us are more or less being asked to pause our lives outside of our homes. And on the one hand, I am really enjoying the simplicity of knowing that none of us has to be anywhere or go do anything. It's perfect for introverted moms. On the other hand, it is, of course, a really funky, uncertain time. And it seems to me, as a highly sensitive introvert, that I just feel as though there is a heaviness in the air around our community. So please know that I am daily praying for you and your family. So grateful that we can journey together and support one another virtually during all of this. Back to Jane Eyre, though, I have a special treat before we dive into the actual chapters. One of our members, Allison, shared something in the forum that I wanted to read out for us. It's a poem by Emily Dickinson, another famous introvert, and she actually wrote it about Charlotte Bronte. It's really fun and special to think of Dickinson being influenced by Bronte's writing, just as we are today. And I think it's just so beautiful. Before I read it, I just wanted to point out a few things, though. So in the poem, she mentions Charlotte Bronte's pseudonym, Currer Bell. She mentions Haworth, which is the village that the Brontes lived in England. And she also mentions the asphodel, which is something I had to look up. That is a flower, a type of lily, and it symbolized immortality, meaning remembered beyond the tomb. So here is the full poem by Emily Dickinson, which is called Charlotte Bronte's Grave. All overgrown by cunning moss, all interspersed with weed, the little cage of Currer Bell in quiet Haworth laid. This bird, observing others, when frosts too sharp became, retire to other latitudes, quietly did the same. But differed in returning, since Yorkshire hills are green, yet not in all the nests I meet can nightingale be seen. Gathered from many wanderings, Gethsemane can tell through what transporting anguish she reached the asphodel. Soft fall the sounds of Eden upon her puzzled ear. Oh, what an afternoon for heaven when Bronte entered there. This gives me chills. I love the imagery of nature, especially her choice to make Charlotte into a bird, which of course brings to mind Jane Eyre and how Jane says to Mr. Rochester, "I am no bird and no net ensnares me." And here Charlotte is no longer ensnared to her body or to this earth, which had represented so much suffering in her short life. And of course, as we contemplate Charlotte's sufferings, we see those mirrored through the ones of Jane in these 6 chapters. So let me attempt to give a summary of all that's going on here. But let's do this by putting yourself in Jane's shoes and imagining that it's your own wedding day nearing. It's just one day away and you are excited but also uneasy. The weather turns stormy and you have a disturbing dream in which you see your home, Thornfield, in ruins. Early on the morning of your wedding day, you walk with Mr. Rochester hand in hand to the church for the ceremony. But just before you can take your vows, you're interrupted by 2 men. One of them, someone you recognize, Mr. Mason from Jamaica, who claims that your husband-to-be already has a wife still living, his very own sister, Bertha Mason. Together as a group, you walk back to Thornfield, where you go all the way up to the 3rd-story locked room and see a woman, Mr. Rochester's wife, who is clearly mentally ill and who attacks him right in front of you before being restrained by your fiance and by her caretaker, Grace Poole. And now all the pieces begin to fall into place. The strange noises, the laugh, the fire on Mr. Rochester's bed, the attack of Mr. Mason, and even as you see your own world and all your future hopes vanish like a mist. After retreating and grieving in your bedroom, because where else would an introvert go? The man you love begs you to run away with him to another land where you can live together as man and wife and no one would ever have to know. He gets angry and even borders violence when you resist this plan. So you determine that your only course of action is to tear yourself away from all you love the most, leaving Thornfield before dawn the next morning without anyone knowing, first on foot and then by coach, which goes on to be a huge problem when you get off the coach without taking the small amount of money and food you had brought with you. Listen, friends, if you are ever fleeing, promise me that you will hold on to your bag in the carriage and not put it down, because that will save you a lot of future stress. But for now, you are reduced to a homeless beggar, eventually stumbling upon a home called Marsh End, where you're first denied entry, but are later welcomed by its residents, Mr. St. John Rivers, his sisters, Mary and Diana, and their older servant, Hannah. You tell them that your name is Jane Elliott, and after recovering your health, you ask for work. St. John, who is clergyman over the area, extends an invitation for you to begin a school in a nearby village for poor girls, and you accept, starting a new life for yourself. Whew! Okay, so now that I've ruined your wedding day, why don't we dig in and explore some of the themes here that apply specifically to us as introverted women, because there is a lot going on, as you can tell. One such part that intrigued me is in chapter 25, when Jane meets Mr. Rochester outside after he's been away. Now, this is before the wedding, and she has had this horrible experience with her dream of Thornfield in ruins, and then she goes on to tell him about a lady who she has never seen before that was in her bedroom in the middle of the night and tore her wedding veil in half. And at that time, Jane had fainted, just as she did once when we first met her back in the Red Room. So she confides all of this from the depths of her troubled heart to her fiancé. And how does he respond to this? He blames her nerves and her sensitivity. Ah, yep. So listen in to what happens.
"Now, sir, tell me who and what that woman was."
"The creature of an overstimulated brain, that is certain. I must be careful of you, my treasure. Nerves like yours were not made for rough handling."
"Sir, depend on it, my nerves were not in fault. The thing was real. The transaction actually took place."
Mr. Rochester attempts to convince her that it must have been Grace Poole, although she knows it wasn't. And I would venture to guess that as introverts or highly sensitive people, and even just as women, we have probably found ourselves in this position of having some kind of intuitive insight or experience, and then having it be denied or not taken it seriously, whether it was as a child or later as an adult. It has taken me my entire life of having seen so many of my highly sensitive, introverted insights play out to begin having confidence in speaking out of that reservoir of depth and wisdom when I feel that it's right. But the scene with Jane just angered me to see her run to him for comfort and then be blamed as being overexcitable instead. Now let's head forward a bit past the craziness of the wedding day that never was, And toward the end of chapter 27, the scene in which Mr. Rochester is begging Jane to stay and live with him and be faithful to each other as if they were married, attempting to convince her that it wouldn't be wrong in spirit, even if the law says that it is. And Jane is sorely tempted because all she has ever wanted was to be known and loved, and to know and love another. Isn't that what we all so deeply want? And here it is all within her grasp if she will just agree. And she is fighting an inward battle here like none she has ever known before. And then this beautiful inner response rises within her. Here is what she is thinking.
I care for myself. The more solitary, the more friendless, the more unsustained I am, the more I will respect myself. I will keep the law given by God, sanctioned by man. I will hold to the principles received by me when I was sane and not mad as I am now. Laws and principles are not for the times when there is no temptation. They are for such moments as this, when body and soul rise in mutiny against them. If at my individual convenience I might break them, what would be their worth?
Here's what I took from this. My literary life question for this title has been regarding finding joy and contentment. And this scene, along with all that happens afterward when Jane flees, reminded me that sometimes there's just no joy or contentment in doing the right thing. It is just hard, but that doesn't mean that it's not right. I wrote a blog post about this once in regards to homeschooling specifically that I'll try to share the link for you guys in the forum, where I found homeschooling to just be emotionally really, really hard for years. And that regularly led me to question whether it was truly the right thing for me to be doing. Yet when I would seek God about it, I always had the confirmation that it was right, but it was just hard. So I loved that tough but very needed reminder through Jane's decision-making here. In the next chapter, chapter 28, there is this beautiful scene that almost feels like a reward from God for Jane honoring her obedience. It is when she finds herself homeless, having left behind all of her meager possessions in the coach, and grieving and brokenhearted, she has this experience.
I had risen to my knees to pray for Mr. Rochester. Looking up, I, with tear-dimmed eyes, saw the mighty Milky Way. Remembering what it was, what countless systems there swept space like a soft trace of light, I felt the might and strength of God. Sure was I of his efficiency to save what he had made. Convinced I grew that neither earth should perish, nor one of the souls it treasured. I turned my prayer to thanksgiving. The source of life was also the savior of spirits. Mr. Rochester was safe. He was God's, and by God would he be guarded.
She goes on in this moment to experience a true peace that passes all understanding and is then able to fall asleep. And it's such a reminder of how our suffering can draw us closer to God if we seek Him in a way that ease and prosperity rarely do. And maybe that is applicable to all of us right now as we are experiencing the coronavirus situation. Finally, let's take a look at chapter 30, where we find Jane settling in at Moor House with St. John and his sisters, Diana and Mary. I remember at least one of you in the forums mentioning that your literary life question for this book had to do with overcoming and healing from trauma, and I thought this was a really lovely example of that. We see here that although Jane's heart is completely broken, she still has moments of joy. Somehow God has led her to this family, and especially these sisters who are like kindred spirits to her, and she experiences a true belonging here. Her friendship with these sisters makes me think of her friendship with Helen Burns at Lowood, and I just marveled to see that here it returns to the theme of education, which becomes part of Jane's own healing from trauma. First here in her own learning, and then later her teaching becomes part of her healing, which she goes on to do in the village school that St. John sets up for girls. And just as Helen inspired Jane to want to learn more, now Mary and Diana do the same. This is what we read.
They were both more accomplished and better read than I was, but with eagerness I followed in the path of knowledge they had trodden before me. I devoured the books they lent me. Then it was full satisfaction to discuss with them in the evening what I had perused during the day. Thought fitted thought. Opinion met opinion. We coincided, in short, perfectly.
How good God is to set Jane in this refuge in the midst of her time of need. And I know that He has done the same for me again and again. This final scene leads perfectly to the closing question I wanted to leave you with as we wrap up this episode. It's a question that also relates to the theme of trauma, which is, do you think it's really possible for someone who's been through as much as Jane has, first as a girl and now as a young woman, to be as principled and good and just solid as she appears to be? Or do you think her response is only possible because she is a fictionalized character? This is something I've asked myself each time I've read this book, and I would love to know your thoughts in the forum if you'd like to share them or just to think about on your own as we continue to discuss these chapters. I hope this has been an encouragement, an inspiration, a little break for your brain, friends, and I look forward to chatting with you soon. Please know that I'm praying for you all, and take good care.